from the studios of 96.3 FM Freak Radio in Santa Cruz, California. It's time for the Weekly Freak Show, headlines and highlights for the week ending Thursday, December 14th, 2000. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this half-hour look back at the news and features not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, we'll be speaking with folk musician Jim Page about his life and music, and later, we'll hear from Aleksandra Jovanovic on the recent nonviolent overthrow of Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Don't miss the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. And now, headlines for the week ending Thursday, December 14th, 2000. The Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front have claimed joint responsibility for smashing over 10 windows and spray-painting slogans at a McDonald's corporate office in Long Island, New York, on Friday, December 8th. The Earth Liberation Front also claimed responsibility for a fire on Saturday, December 9th, that destroyed a two-story condominium under construction in Long Island, causing an estimated $500,000 in damage. Three other condos connected to the one that was destroyed sustained minor damage. It took nearly 50 firefighters around an hour to bring the blaze under control. No suspects have been arrested in either incident. Approximately 700 people marched in frigid, sub-zero temperatures in Minneapolis, Minnesota on Sunday, December 10th, calling for President Bill Clinton to grant executive clemency to Leonard Peltier. The Native American activist has been in prison for almost 25 years after being convicted of killing two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. He has steadfastly maintained his innocence. Around 2,000 protesters rallied in front of the United Nations in New York City. Halfway through the march to the UN building, a melee broke out after a high-ranking New York Police Department officer decided to attack a man holding a megaphone. The officer ripped the megaphone from the marcher's hand and threw him to the ground to cuff him. Three other marchers were arrested in the ensuing melee. Just 3 days after 800 demonstrators marched from New York City's Upper West Side to Harlem in support of Mumia Abu-Jamal's freedom, the death row inmate suffered another court setback. On Tuesday, December 12th, a Third Circuit Court of Appeals judge denied Abu-Jamal's request for a writ of mandamus. This would have forced Judge William H. Yon to accept amicus briefs written by the American Civil Liberties Union and the Philadelphia branch of the NAACP. A group of 22 members of the British Parliament also submitted a brief, also denied, that claimed the courts denied Mumia's right to self-representation or to choose his own legal counsel. According to Mumia supporters, the briefs supplemented in detail legal issues crucial to Mumia's pending petition for writ of habeas corpus and explained why Mumia should be granted a new trial or freed. But Yon disagreed. I find that additional filings by amici in this matter are not necessary because the petitioner is adequately represented, Yon wrote. Ruth McKay, an 81-year-old grandmother and peace activist from Concord, New Hampshire, pled no contest to charges of criminal trespass and disorderly conduct in Nashua District Court on Wednesday, December 13th. McKay was arrested on December 4th for attempting to pray in the driveway of the British Aerospace Systems plant in Nashua during a demonstration to protest the company's production of electronic components for weapons that are used against civilians. Judge Philip Howarth sentenced McKay to 13 days in jail after she refused to pay a $260 fine. This is the sixth time McKay has been jailed for an act of civil disobedience at the Nashua weapons plant. Two other women arrested during the demonstration, Hattie Nestel, age 61, of Athol, Massachusetts, and Dade Singapuri, age 67, of Amherst, Massachusetts, pled not guilty to charges of disorderly conduct and will be tried in Nashua District Court on January 29, 2001. And finally, a group of 55 protesters from across Europe formed a human chain across the main entrance to the NATO headquarters in Brussels on Thursday, December 14th, where foreign ministers were meeting to discuss NATO arms control and disarmament policy. A banner covering the side of a truck featuring a U.S. flag with a montage of missiles and radiation symbols called on Europe to stop Star Wars. A 10-meter-long helium balloon floating above the truck communicated the message to those inside the building. A key criteria set by the Clinton administration before the United States National Missile Defense System could be approved was that it must be supported by Americans' European allies. There has already been public opposition from a number of countries, including France, Germany, China, and Russia. Many nations believe Star Wars would damage existing and future arms reduction agreements and greatly increase the risk of nuclear war. 2 out of 3 Star Wars tests conducted under ideal conditions have been dismal failures. And those were headlines for the week ending Thursday, December 14th, 2000. Jim Page has been busking on the streets of Seattle for the better part of 3 decades. His brand of folk music inspires many, and he sings about people's daily lives. On a recent stop in Santa Cruz to promote his newest album, Didn't We?, he stopped by the Freak Radio Studios to discuss what life is like for a modern-day folk musician. I was joined by Freak Radio's Skidmark Bob, and we took turns asking him some questions.
So, are you still playing on the streets?
I still do that, yeah. I don't do it a lot, but I do it enough. I'll tell you one thing. Unless something physical happened to me, I'm going to keep doing that when the time is right and the place is right. Because there's things you can do out there that are so totally spectacularly whimsical, tweaky, that you can't do many places.
Yeah.
I'm serious. I mean, you can have so much fun out there. It's just a total blast. I can't see not doing it if the situation presents itself.
You ever been hassled by the police?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, they come, noise complaints or anything like
that? Well, no, not noise complaints, but I kind of, I created the street singing law in Seattle. The reason that the streets are open is because of me. I was playing on the streets, I got there in 71, and I started doing rock and roll band breaks. I got there just as the last folk club closed, right?
Wow.
Which, you know, on the one hand was depressing, and on the other hand, it was the best thing that could happen. Because that meant that I had to, as an acoustic guitar player, I had to make my own scene. I had to make it. All there was everything else, other than folk clubs, because there weren't any. So I was bemoaning my situation to a bartender, as most people do in the civilized world. And he said, well, why don't you go across the street and play? There's a club across the street, it's a rock club. And I said, well, it's a rock club, they're rock bands. He says, they take breaks, don't they? Okay, so I went in there and I played. I asked if I could play, and they looked at me like, well, if you want to, go ahead. You know, and I played a few tunes during the break, and I passed my hat. And I did that for 7 years.
Wow.
But I also went out. I was invited to go out and play on the campus, university campus. I went out there, started playing out there. Started playing on the street. And, I was playing more. I was having a better time, and I was playing more than I would have if there had been a folk scene. Because if there had been a folk scene, I might have just stayed in that.
Right.
You know, and then you run into all the kind of one-upsmanship and stuff that entails. But there wasn't any one-upsmanship because there was no scene. So I got to make it. I played cocktail bars. I played city council meetings. I played the bus station. I played, just everything. So one day I'm down there playing in front of Oliver's Meats on, between 2nd and 1st on Pike there. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was there then. Oliver's Meats. It was a butcher shop, as you would guess. And this motorcycle cop came up. And he walked right up to me, and this was like 74, I think. He walked right up, and he said, can I see your permit? And I said, I don't have one. And he says, well, then you can't play here. And I said, I'll go get one. And he said, you can't because you're not blind. And he rode off. And he was in a bad mood.
You had to be blind to play.
Yeah, well, I thought, I didn't know what he was talking about exactly, but I figured I'd find out. So I went down to City Hall and started asking questions, and I found out, yes, there was a law on the books that had been passed sometime in the 40s, I think, which made it illegal to play music on the street for the purpose of soliciting donations, which is how they like to put it.
Really?
Unless you are blind or disabled. unless you have a permit, and the only permit available was for blind or disabled people. So it was like a catch-22 thing. So I figured, shit, man, I'm going to, you know, have some fun with this. So I started, I made some friends in the newspapers, and I made some friends in the TV. I had my supporters, and I started, you know, I got to talk to everybody, the mayor. I got to talk to the mayor, you know, city council people and stuff. And, you know, I made this deal out of it. They worked out a special permit thing for me so I could play at the zoo. I played at the zoo in front of the monkey pool for a number of years while this was going on. It was a blast.
Monkeys like it?
They did. They scratched along with the music. They did. They had this rhythmical scratching thing they would do. It was appealing. Anyway, so then we had the city council meeting, which was set up to decide, right? And I made these little flyers. Jim Bays live at city council chambers. You know, chambers 2:30, Tuesday or whatever. You know, and I put them all over town. You know, we packed the place. It was great. I wrote this song for it and everything. And guess who? I'll give you one guess. Who the only organization was which opposed street singing? This was 1974. The only organization in Seattle to oppose street music.
The Downtown Association?
No, oddly enough. I don't know if we had a Downtown Association at the time. The Musicians Union.
Why?
Because you wouldn't be guaranteed union scale. Because the streets aren't union for musicians. You know, it's that old thing. But everybody else, nobody cared. Nobody cared. So it was passed. It became a law. The streets are completely wide open. You can play anywhere at any time. There's certain restrictions, but they're vague and they're generous, you know. Because nobody cared. That was before Seattle got famous. And I'll bet anything that if someone tried to do, if that hadn't happened then, and you tried to do it now, it'd be real hard.
Right.
Well, things are getting weird up north. It hasn't gotten that weird on the street music yet, but on street people in general, or people outdoors, you know, like the no sitting ordinances, the no aggressive panhandling ordinances.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, we had one here a few years back.
And we got so many plainclothes security people going around. Now, like the latest one is called the Metropolitan Improvement District. Now, that sounds like a place, doesn't it?
Hmm.
The Metropolitan Improvement District. Well, that's it's a security force. You know, when they walk around these pleasant blue and white jackets, they look like maybe you're just, I don't know, liaison between the, you know, tourist and the shopping or something.
Like we have hosts.
Hosts. The same sort of thing. Host. Hi. Here's your ticket. Welcome to Santa Cruz. Here's your ticket, and there's a public safety building. Go over there.
Right. Wow, that's interesting.
Jim, I had a question. I'm curious how you made the connection between your music and being able to reach people with a message. What was it for you that pushed you over that edge?
I learned that. I learned that through doing.
Yeah,
I learned through doing. I'm from here, basically. I'm from San Jose. Right? I graduated in the late 60s from high school, and I went right into, you know, all that stuff that was going on then, which for me at the time was basically just getting stoned at the time, whatever. But there was all this stuff going on, and the music had a lot of social relevance in it. It did. It had a lot of immediacy in it. People were sticking their necks out in the music. So I went in that direction also, but I didn't know anything. I really didn't. Then, you know, one thing leads to another, and I wind up in Seattle, and like I was saying earlier, the folk club closed when I got there, so I was left with whatever I could get. Well, I learned I had to, for my own survival, speak. I had to actually speak to people to make them an audience so they would listen to me so that we could get some sort of, you know, coordinated conversation going so I could get money in the hat. And I learned through trial and error that if I sang about what was going on in people's lives, they would come back to see me again. And once you do that, they will not only come back and see you again, but they will expect more of you. And they will invite you into their homes, and they will invite you to see what's going on, and you will get affected, and you will become a part of it. And that's what happened to me. I became a part of it because I needed, for my own survival, to create this immediate communication. And I learned what a song could do firsthand. I mean, I love it. I love it. I totally love it. Yeah.
How do you see yourself, you know, in terms of trying to produce your own music and get it out there, as going against the grain towards the, you know, the major record industry that we have?
I'm not the only person doing it.
No, that's true.
Millions of us.
I know, that's true.
It's part of a whole international thrust to decentralize, you know, to basically shoot rocks at Goliath. I mean, that's what we're all doing. And it's totally great. I mean, you don't need that stuff. You don't need a house on the hill. You don't need a limousine. You don't need, you know, an A&R man. You don't need any of that stuff. You can do it yourself. There are computer programs. You can, you know, mix your own music. I got a friend out there in Eastern Washington. He's got everything. He made his last CD in his house. He's got two microphones. You know, and he's got a little program on his computer, a little mixing board. He made the whole thing himself. Designed the artwork himself. Sent it off to the presser. You know, I mean, the place I go to in Seattle has a 10-day turnaround. There's places in San Francisco have a 2-day turnaround. You don't need the big pressing plants. You don't need any of that stuff anymore.
And now with the internet, too, you can distribute your music that way as well. I know a lot of people are doing that. Like David Rovix and others like him are putting their stuff out on the web. I don't know, are you on the web at all?
I will be soon. Yeah. I've been very resistant, but, you know, trying to figure out the programs and what the hell that stuff is made of was mind-boggling. And finally, this young fellow up in Seattle who, like, does computer stuff for a living. He designs websites and maintains them and stuff. You know, came up and said, I'll build a website for you. I'd love to. So it's almost done. It'll be done in the next couple of weeks. It'll be up by, you know, first of the year. And it's jimpage.net. So then I have to make all the links and stuff. But, I mean, it's totally great. It's totally democratizing everything. If we just keep in contact with each other, we can all survive. We can all make a tremendous difference, and we can give these people a run for their, you know, wallets. You know, we can. We don't need the Borders books. We don't need that stuff. We can do perfectly well without it, but we need to keep in contact with each other. It's like a test. Can we keep talking to each other? You know? If we can do that, then we'll survive. We'll not only survive, we'll prevail. I think it's unavoidable for us.
How do you feel about being on a pirate radio station?
I love it. I think there ought to be more. I'm trying to... when I was out there at Pine Ridge, a friend of mine, Robert Quiver, he's head of, or one of the heads of the Lakota Student Alliance, grandson of Oscar Bear Runner. He was talking about wanting me to help him set up, get the gear together to set up a micro station out there. They've got a radio station, Keeley Radio, KILI, but, you know, it's FCC stuff, and they have to be careful of certain things, and, you know, things that kind of edgy out there from time to time, and it'd be great to have, like, this network of communication. So I'm trying to get him together with all the right sources to get all the stuff, you know, lined up, and then we can do, you know, benefits or whatever to raise the money,
right.
You know, a couple of grand, and you've got yourself a station, right?
$1,000 cost us to get on the air. That was 6 years ago.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
A bunch of people decided, hey, we heard about Free Radio Berkeley, and this press here wasn't doing us any bit of justice at all, so we decided to do it ourselves.
Yeah. No, I think it's necessary. It's survival, you know.
But there's a song you do that mentions pirate radio.
Yeah. It's called Take Our Culture Back.
Yeah, we can't let you go without singing that song.